Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Richard Conniff has written about the spineless, the slimy, the creepy, and the repulsive for magazines like Smithsonian and National Geographic. His descriptions of strange behaviors and astonishing truths about nightmare-inducing critters of the natural world have won awards and made readers' skin crawl. In the name of research, Richard Conniff has gone swimming with piranhas and gotten up close and personal with leeches. He does it all again, sort of, in his new book, The Natural History of the Rich. This time, Conniff's camouflage is a rented red Ferrari, and his compass is everything that evolutionary psychology tells us about human behavior, and especially the behavior of humans with big money, big wealth. There are no flesh-eating fish in Conniff's new waters, but there are socialites who recall bonobo monkeys and CEOs who puff up like ruffed grouses and fornicate like well-fed howler monkeys. Think lifestyles of the rich and famous with a streak of wicked naturalist. Are the rich really different, or are humans of every tax bracket just as strange and complex as the alpha males and moguls, aristocrats and strivers of Conniff's latest extreme habitat? And if the rich are so odd, why does everyone want to be one of them? I want to welcome Richard Conniff, author of The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide. Welcome.
Thanks, Tom. Great introduction.
It's great to have you. So we're wading in here, but give us a little of your background first. You literally have tracked wildlife along lines we more often associate with that phrase all over the world. You've written books on spineless wonders, invertebrates, and every creeping thing, repulsive wildlife. I mean, you really are a National Geographic, Smithsonian kind of writer generally. Is that right?
Yeah, but I've also had this other life over the years. I've written about the rich for Architectural Digest, so I've gone back and forth between the rich and the beastly.
Truly the chronicle of the rich in their overbuilt habitats.
Yeah.
Architectural Digest.
Absolutely.
So even so, it must have been kind of a jump to go from Spineless Wonders to a full book on the rich. What got you off the dime? What got you out of the swamps and into country clubs and Monaco and you name it?
Well, actually, it was a National Geographic assignment in Monaco, and it was a kind of a surreal place where every conversation kind of would veer off into the absurd without any notice. For instance, one day I was having lunch with these two beautiful young women seeking starter husbands, and I asked one of them to teach me some French, and the phrase that came dancing to her lips was, "Il a du fric," which means he's loaded. And I really wasn't. And that's, I think, partly why I was having so much trouble fitting in Monaco. And then one day I ran into the stockbroker. He was a Brit. And he looked at me and he said, "National Geographic, why aren't you in the mountains of Papua New Guinea?" So I started to explain to him that every nation has its own anthropology and that what I was seeing in Monaco was at least as exotic as any hill tribe running naked through the rainforests. And it sort of went on from there. I actually ran into that stockbroker a few nights later in a piano bar, and he immediately began doing this this riff on Monaco natural history. He said, "Here you have the tribal mating ritual, everyone out on display, lots of plumage, lots of cross-fertilization." And I said, "You know, you sound like David Attenborough."
But because you've done real naturalist writing, we're tempted to take you a bit seriously about cultural evolution and a kind of scientific analysis of behavior. How much science and how much pseudoscience, though, can we really bring to talking about rich human beings, Homo sapiens?
In the beginning, I treated this as a lark, a bit of a joke. I said that the rich are different from you and me. They do more scent marking. But then I got into it, and I started to – by the way, that's a joke the rich have made too. Mrs. Armand Hammer once said that a telephone is to Armand what a fire plug is to a dog. He can't pass one without using it. The only difference is he lifts the receiver instead of his leg.
Though the scent marking may be leaving libraries instead of fire hydrant marking sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Anyway, I started with this joke, but then I started to look around. And in the beginning, before I actually committed myself to the book, I asked whether I could apply biological ideas to an economic class, and it seemed absurd. So I started looking at things like dominance behavior and display behavior and habitat and mating behavior and seeing how those ideas played out with the rich. And it really was still a lark for much of the way. In fact, I treat the whole thing with humor throughout.
You write about the similarity between baboons and characters in a Jane Austen novel.
Yeah. At one point, I made a trip. I started at Blenheim Palace, where I was interviewing the 11th Duke of Marlborough, got straight onto a plane.
This is the Churchill family manse.
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. And a huge place it is, 187 rooms.
Beautiful to look at, maybe not so fun to live in.
No. Actually, there's been a long history of pretty wretched lives there. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so I went straight from there to the Okavango Delta, where I went out to visit a troop of baboons and the biologists who were studying them. And the biologists made this Jane Austen analogy. They said that, just as in the human world, it's all about cultivating your family and getting in with influential individuals higher up the ladder than you.
We're going to hear about the conclusions you've drawn about the behavior of the rich and what's in the blood and what's just in the money. We'll dive into all that, but I want to step back with you for a second. I mean, given that the book is half for real and half facetious, yet we live in a time when there's a microscope on the rich like perhaps there hasn't been in many decades, not since the Gilded Age. There's a lot of attention, a lot of criticism, a lot of fear that we live in a period of oligarchy, of plutocracy, of rule by the rich. Does that make this a more important subject for us right now to kind of expose these masters of the universe for what they are, what they are not, and figure out how to interact with folks who have so much of society's resources?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the way the question generally gets phrased when I go around and do talks about the book is, where on earth did Dennis Kozlowski come from?
This is the Tyco CEO with the $6,000 shower curtain.
Yeah, and actually there's a kind of idea in the biological community even that alpha behavior in the human world is deviant, as one researcher put it. And we all tend to assume that these alphas are a bit freakish, that they are the product of warped childhoods or messed up marriages. But in fact, I think by looking at the animal world, we find that greedy, grabby, self-aggrandizing individuals are entirely natural.
Zoomorphism is the word you pull out to describe looking at humans as if they were animals. When you began to do that with humans, with rich human beings, what parallels first came into view?
Well, dominance behavior is the natural thing to look at because people who build fortunes, the Ted Turners and the Larry Ellisons of the world, do so with these very aggressive styles of social dominance. And they use a lot of the same tools that an alpha baboon would use. A lot of glowering, a lot of shouting, tirades, a lot of bluster, often surprisingly a use of sheer commanding physical presence. I mean, the rich, the people who build fortunes often tend to be taller. They did a study of the Fortune 500 back in the 1980s, and they found that they were averaging, the heads of the corporations were averaging 6 feet when the average American male was 5'10".
But all the shouting and glowering, it makes the rich sound like madmen or football coaches, and that's not the picture that you present.
I think that there is a certain element of monomania, and that is what makes a guy like Ted Turner or Larry Ellison successful in part. That is, they are so single-minded, so determined to get what they want, that we get out of their way or we even follow behind because that determination almost that at the risk of self-preservation is what impresses us. Somebody described the internet billionaire Jim Clark, and they said that he always wins the game of chicken because people just think he might just enjoy a head-on collision.
So maybe they are a little bit mad and a little bit like that monomaniacal football coach in that way.
Oh, yeah, and also a little bit like alphas in the chimpanzee world. For instance, Jane Goodall describes a chimp named Mike who became an alpha, and he's being pursued by 5 males, and he does the sensible thing. He flees into the trees, but then he just stops dead, and he turns around, and he faces them down, clearly at risk of his own well-being. And the others are so shocked by this that they run in the opposite direction as fast as they can. And so that, again, that kind of that willingness to risk everything is what impresses and makes some of these people into leaders.
Richard Cunniff, you took your rented red Ferrari into this world looking for examples. Give us some examples or anecdotes that you come across of this kind of dominance behavior among the wealthy.
Okay. Well, that Ferrari was a bad idea, actually. It was a $150,000 Ferrari, and I thought it was a way to assume the disguises of the rich and to pretend almost to be one of them. And I drove it around to various places in Los Angeles. And first of all, nobody noticed because it's the kind of car they give the kids for high school graduation. And second, it was the wrong car for me on a number of grounds, not least of all because it had a $10,000 deductible. And so every time I drove into a driveway and the front end sort of scraped on the apron, my face would blanch. And I think anybody who saw me in that car would see a big sign on my forehead which said, rental. So I wasn't, fooling anybody.
But it was your effort at camouflage. It didn't entirely work. And yet you were inside the envelope.
Yes.
How does dominance work? Not on a football field or on a patch of silverback ape land, you know, in Rwanda, but in the haunts of the rich.
A lot of times it's, in fact, mostly, it's a lot more subtle than what I was talking about just now with this monomania. For instance, I was in the Bel Air section of Los Angeles, and I went to visit a producer. And you drive up into a pretty exclusive neighborhood to start with, and then you go up a cul-de-sac, and you're at the end of the cul-de-sac, and there's a large wall in front of you with a huge oaken gate, and you speak into a rock, basically, and if you say the right words, the doors swing open. And then you go up this winding driveway, and, you know, past little subsidiary houses before you come to the great mansion at the top of this 12-acre estate at the top of a hill in the middle of Bel Air. And then you have to go through five or six other gate-like passages before you get into a sort of anteroom where he meets people. And then, you know, you have the art on the walls and it's pretty good art. And then on top of that, in case you don't get it, there's a book on the coffee table by the artist which shows the same art so that you know it's the real thing.
So you know it's the real deal. Who put it there? The Tiffany lamp is a real Tiffany lamp.
Absolutely. And there's a photograph, a Harrell photograph of Greta Garbo on the wall staring down rather hard, intimidating.
Are these all the trappings of dominance?
Absolutely. You know, you come into a place like this and you feel a bit cowed and also you tend to kowtow a bit. You tend to – I mean, I do this when I go to these houses for Architectural Digest. You tend to be just a bit subservient. You don't grovel exactly, but you know your place.
But the organism in the middle of this great shell of opulence – is it really different than the regular schmo out in the street?
Well, actually, Peter Guber was a very friendly guy, and he latched onto this idea quite happily. And a lot of the rich did, as long as I was talking about other rich people. They were very interested in looking at them as animals. He was very approachable. But I guess what's interesting to me about the rich and what makes them different, what makes them – I call them a cultural subspecies – is that they draw themselves out from the rest of the population and they go off to live in these areas like Bel Air or like Aspen or like Palm Beach where they only see other rich people. And they behave in different ways with each other. And in those ways, yeah, I think it's fair to talk about them as a cultural subspecies.
Different in the sense that their interactions are just exaggerated or less materially worried versions of ordinary middle-class human beings or really different in some way. I mean, obviously, genetically, they're just like you and me. There's tremendous turnover. We read from the Republican side, at least, in the ranks of American wealth. So many of them were not wealthy 100 years ago in their gene pool.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. There's no genetic difference, and anybody who would pretend otherwise is fooling themselves. Behaviorally, I think that they exercise – first of all, their use of dominance behavior in many ways may be the same as ours. For instance, you have middle managers who glower and shout and try to get their way with sort of aggressive dominance. But it makes a great deal more difference when it's Bill Gates or when it's Larry Ellison. Companies die or become profitable as a result. People lose their jobs or get new jobs as a result. So, yeah, I think that makes their behaviors more interesting. And second, I think that they also do things a bit differently. They exercise dominance in ways that we don't really for instance, through philanthropy, through having great art on the walls, through having these huge houses that are so intimidating. It shows up in their sexual behavior, in their mating habitat, their mating habits.
We will talk about all that. Richard Conniff, stand by. We've got to take a short break. Listeners, we're talking this hour with Richard Conniff, author of The Natural History of the Rich. We're not taking any calls this hour, but you can get involved in the conversation online. Go to our website, onpointradio.org, and click on Forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Richard Conniff, author of The Natural History of the Rich, a field guide just out from W.W. Norton. He is also the author of Spineless Wonders, Strange Tales from the Invertebrate World, and Every Creeping Thing, True Tales of Faintly Repulsive Wildlife. This time out, Richard Conniff, who has written for National Geographic and the Smithsonian, is coming out writing about the rich in their natural habitat and looking at them as a kind of, well, very well-heeled baboons in our midst. You said, Richard Conniff, that the rich sort of cottoned to this idea of being looked at as a special subspecies.
Yes, especially when I was talking to them about other people, other rich people. They were fascinated by that. And actually, since the book has come out, I've been getting kind of surprising reactions. I was a little bit worried how they would respond to this, but I've gotten notes from rich people saying that they liked it, that they understood their motives a little bit better than they had before. I actually had a meeting with a guy last week. It was sort of as if he was asking for tips that he could use in the boardroom, tips from animal behavior.
Such as?
Well, we were talking about dominance behavior by being aggressive in this baboon or Larry Ellison style that I talked about earlier.
So it's cycling and all the way through. He's reading your book, being reminded that there's dominance behavior, and now he wants to put it straight to work in the boardroom.
Yeah, but actually what we were talking about was about dominance by being nice, because that's not really such an obvious idea. But in the animal world, for instance, in chimps, alphas will go out and they'll hunt, they'll get meat, and they won't just gobble it down themselves. They'll have feeding clusters, and they will call in their subordinates, and they will share the food with them. And in one particular case in Tanzania where a group was being studied, the alpha actually gave away the meat and didn't take a bite himself, and he gained enormous stature as a result of his generosity, and he remained in power much longer.
So philanthropy, a delightful sort of side undertaking of the rich, can actually be something that confirms power.
You bet. And I don't think this would come as any surprise to them, because they often use it pretty explicitly to get what they want. But I think what's surprising is that it's also true in the natural world. Mm. For instance, there's a bird in the Middle East called the Arabian babbler. They live in the desert. And what happens is the alpha will go out and he'll get a worm. And instead of consuming it himself, he'll go look for a beta. And then he'll make the beta beg. The beta actually has to pretend to be a nestling. It sort of crouches down, flaps its wings, puts its mouth up, and its gaping mouth is there, just like a nestling. And then the dominant shoves the worm down the subordinate's throat.
So largesse confirms largeness. Richard, kind of, how did you define rich for the purpose of this book? Where's the point at which it goes from being affluence to enough wealth that it begins, in your view, to separate behavior out?
Okay. Wealth, obviously, the definition of wealth obviously varies pretty drastically from one country to another. So it's
one
entirely
family
relative
to another.
Yeah, absolutely. And even within a family among the rich, and they're very conscious of that. But in this country, as a rule, banks and university fundraisers start to look at you a little bit differently when you have about $7 million in loose change, not counting your primary residence.
So that is $7 million that you might invest, that you might give away a chunk of.
Yes.
Although $7 million must be seen by the upper tier as a real pittance, as a starting
Absolutely.
Point.
Absolutely. If you took that money to Aspen, you could barely buy a house.
And with your naturalist hat on here, what are the telltale characteristics? I mean, can you now, having focused on this as you have, walk down the street and say, he's rich, she's rich, she's rich, he's rich?
Yeah, the rich are actually pretty good at disguising that when they want to. I mean, in Aspen, for instance, you'd see a Range Rover going by and you might think, oh, that guy's got money. And then somebody else that you were with would say, oh, that's a real estate agent or that's a land surveyor. And the people who had the money were driving around in six-year-old Jeep Cherokees. So there are an awful lot of ways of disguising who you are. Phil Anschutz, who was worth about $9 billion last time I looked, wears a Timex watch. And the King of Jordan likes to run around in rags and New Balance sneakers. And yet I think you can, with training, spot signs of the style of dominance. A guy who works as a captain at a restaurant, let's say at Le Cirque, you stand there and you see people coming through the door and you have a few seconds to make a snap judgment about who they are. Mm-hmm. And by the way they walk, by the attitudes of the people around them, those kind of trained professionals can usually make a pretty good assessment of where that person ought to be seated.
And is that something that can be faked by a bravado, or is there something about that 7, 8, 9-figure bank account that turns up the amplitude on that dominance posture?
Well, I know from my Ferrari experience that I couldn't fake it. Now, I'm sure other people can, but primates have this built-in cheating detection system. I mean, we are always scrutinizing one another to see if the other person is what he or she is pretending to be. And the rich, I think, do this a lot more than the rest of us, possibly because there's more at stake. But, you know, they're always looking for you to drop the names of the right people or the right restaurants or to go to the right vacation places. There are all these little signs, have your kids go to the right schools, all these little signs that, you know, it would take a lot of faking, I think. And as I say, I couldn't do it.
Introduce us to a few of the more colorful characters that you studied and write about. You mentioned Aspen. One of the guys you talked about there was Victor. Is it Kozeny?
Yeah, Victor Kozeny. He is an interesting case because he came to Aspen, bought the most expensive house in town, a huge place up on Red Mountain, and immediately set out to have a big party, which is how the rich often establish themselves in a community. And so he had a party that became the talk of Aspen for years afterwards because of its lavishness. The truffles were served like potato chips, you know, and the caviar was laid on like, I don't know, peanut butter. I mean, it was as if there were no limits, and there were really no limits. And then afterwards, he started to go through the pictures that the event photographer had taken and ask who was who and get to know them. And over a period of a year or so, he began to entertain them around the world, and they wanted to get involved with his investment schemes.
This is a man who had essentially ripped off a bunch of his fellow citizens in Czechoslovakia during the period of privatization, and now he was giving the American rich, his new acquaintances, the chance to do the same in, was it Kazakhstan, Azerbaijan?
Yeah. Azerbaijan. And the interesting thing about that was that a year before he arrived in Aspen, Fortune magazine had done a lengthy article about him describing him as the pirate of Prague. And these people should have known that. But as one of the people from Aspen put it afterwards, we knew he was a pirate, but we thought he would be our pirate.
Instead, he took a bunch of them down with him, but you had the most opulent display of fine plumage that drew in the other rich around and confirmed him in their circle. How about Larry Ellison, famous as the head of Oracle? But you've got some stories about Larry that I had not heard.
Larry Ellison lives in morbid fascination and horror of Microsoft because there's just no way he can ever approach that degree of success and wealth, or at least it doesn't seem that way to me. About 2 years ago, he actually managed to pass Paul Allen of Microsoft on the Forbes 400 list. Mm-hmm. He became the second richest man in the world for one brief shining moment.
This is Paul Allen, who was the co-founder with Bill Gates of Microsoft.
Yeah, and only Bill Gates was left standing between him and glory. Anyway, so Larry Ellison is off in Italy celebrating in his yacht, and yacht is probably an understatement there because it's a 200-foot-plus ship. Mm-hmm. And he's leaving harbor, and he sees another ship in the same range also leaving harbor, and he recognizes it because the rich are always acutely aware of who's who and which airplane is next to them at the airport and all that sort of thing. So he recognizes that it's Paul Allen, and he revs his engines up to full speed, and he guns past him, cuts across his bow, and he wakes Paul Allen's yacht and sends everybody on board lurching into the bulkheads.
Rocks the ship.
He rocks the ship, and that's just classic displacement by an alpha baboon right there, you know, making the others sort of
My ship's longer, bigger, and heavier, and you can just eat my wake. Henry Nicholas with Broadcom.
Yeah, that's he's an interesting character because he's deliberately set out to build a reputation as a loud, fast, aggressive person. And he's also got that monomaniacal quality of setting impossible goals for himself personally in terms of his physical conditioning and also impossible goals for his corporations. And he drives people relentlessly. But he also deliberately creates this image of shouting at his employees in front of reporters. And one of his subordinates told me when I was out there that, in fact, he arranges these sessions beforehand with his victims so that they actually stage.
Don't feel bad. I'm going to be just trouncing on you, but it's okay.
Yeah, and what this does is it says, this is a really scary guy. Don't cross his path. And so rivals just back down without even having to enter the contest.
Dominance is the absolutely consistent theme here. Ted Turner, he's a guy who knows how to crank up the mouth, too.
Yeah, Ted, and clearly the craziness is a tool that has served him very well there, I mean, throughout his life. When he gave that $1 billion to the United Nations, right before that, he'd been having this huge brawl with Rupert Murdoch. He actually challenged Rupert Murdoch to a pay-per-view boxing match. he said it would be like Rocky, kind of only for old guys, and if Murdoch wanted to wear headgear, he could, but he wasn't gonna. Anyway, so clearly the guy's playing on his looniness, and yet it wasn't getting him the traction that he wanted, this aggressive dominance. And so, you know, that was another case, the UN gift, giving $1 billion, a case of achieving dominance by being nice. It was, as he made clear beforehand, the largest single act of charity by a human being in history up to that point.
Top that, Buster. I am rich. And then you quote Winston Churchill, who said, "We are all worms, but I do believe that I am a glow worm." I wonder about this. You know that in the 19th century, the robber barons grabbed on to Darwin, and they loved the survival of the fittest notion because it was a way of praising themselves and bashing the poor. You quote John D. Rockefeller saying, "Wealth represented the working out of a law of nature and a law of God." Here we are at the beginning of the 21st century. How do the rich understand themselves as blessed by nature, by God, by the survival of the fittest, and Darwin's book? Is it still working for them?
Well, it's interesting. You know, John D. Rockefeller, Sr. actually thought that his enterprise was anti-Darwinian and that it was a Christian enterprise, kind of a funny view of how he was working, given his tendencies to monopoly. But I don't try to do that survival of the fittest thing in this book. I really tried to avoid it because I didn't want to be accused of social Darwinism. One of the things that interested me most was how we respond to the rich and how our evolution gears us to look at them.
How the non-rich see the rich and accept their place in the pecking order? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah. Why are we so fascinated with them? And why are we willing to do such really absurd and self-sacrificing things for them? And, spending time in Africa among primates, I was with baboons mostly, but with almost any group of primates, you get the sense that status is the one thing that drives everyone. They have what biologists call Machiavellian intelligence. They are constantly concerned with who's doing what to whom, and they are also constantly concerned with what the alpha is doing. They're always looking up the ladder. And that heritage, going back 30 million years or more, is what we've inherited, and we have that same Machiavellian intelligence, and we also have that same urge to imitate the alpha.
You read about wahoo contests. What's that?
Well, among a lot of dominant animals, you don't actually establish or maintain your dominance with physical violence. You do ritualized forms of physical violence. And in the baboons, they do this. Two males will chase one another through the dust and up into the trees, and they will scream wahoo at each other, but much, much louder. Mm-hmm. And the one who shouts loudest and longest is actually the one who's likeliest to win.
There are other examples of behavior that you see perhaps coming down from that kind of long ago ape heritage. You've got a wonderful little segment here called Mwah, Mwah, about the air kiss. I wish you'd read that for us, Richard Conniff.
I'd be happy to.
This is Richard Conniff reading from his new book, The Natural History of the Rich, a Field Guide, a little segment called Moi, Moi.
The air kiss, for instance, may seem like a modern affectation, a snobby kind of mannerism, as the etiquette expert Letitia Baldridge has put it. But in truth, there's something ancient going on when fashionable partygoers greet one another by pooching out their mouths, parting their lips with a moist clicking or chirping sound, and saying, moi, moi, into the air beside one another's ears. Primatologists call it lip smacking. It's a ritualized imitation of grooming behavior. Monkeys and apes use it as a gesture of appeasement to disarm potential rivals. Like partygoers, they also sometimes use their version of the air kiss deceptively as a prelude to backstabbing. For instance, the American biologists Robert Seyfarth and Dorothy Cheney lived for years among a troop of vervet monkeys in Kenya's Amboseli National Park. One day they observed a female being groomed by a male named Escoffier. The female's daughter, a vervet princess named Leslie, apparently disapproved of this relationship and launched an assault on Escoffier, who fled. Leslie plunked herself down and groomed her mother for a few minutes proprietarily. Then she walked over to Escoffier, who cowered. The remorseful Leslie lip-smacked, and Escoffier allowed her to approach and groom him, a case of air kiss and make-up, or so it seemed. Leslie swept her fingers through his hair, picking out burrs, dirt, invisible bits of dander. Escoffier gradually unwound. Finally, he stretched himself out languidly so Leslie could groom his back. At this point, the biologists write, Leslie picked up Escoffier's tail and bit it, holding it in her teeth while Escoffier screamed. The incident suggests that some behaviors have indeed passed intact from our monkey forebears directly to the Forbes 400. We still lip-smack exactly like monkeys, and having disarmed our rivals, we also still bite them on the ass, though nowadays it may not happen until 3 days later in the form of a blind item in the gossip columns.
When the knife goes in, Richard Conniff drawing the line between our ancestral apes and the lifestyles of the rich and famous and sometimes not so famous today in his new book, The Natural History of the Rich, a Field Guide. Mooning the giant, Richard Conniff, what is that?
Mooning the giant is this behavior where you have somebody who's immensely powerful, a Bill Gates, and you do something deliberately provocative, even suicidally provocative, to sort of get back at him. The pie in the face incident, I guess, is mooning the giant. But the other incident that interested me was it involved Sun Microsystems a few years ago when Microsoft was introducing Windows 2000, and Windows 2000 was notorious for bugs. So some executives from Sun went and hired exterminators and got a bunch of yellow trucks, and they were going to circle the auditorium where Microsoft was announcing Windows 2000 to sort of make this bug connection a little bit more obvious. And that's mooning the giant.
So that's something that the little might love to do to the big, but do the rich moon each other in that way, or is it just not worth it? They have too many common shared interests.
Actually, I was just I was visiting this Hollywood producer just this past week. He made Apollo 13, and Apollo 13 lost at the Academy Awards to Braveheart. And in a corner of his room, he had a photograph that Mel Gibson had given him. And it was the entire cast of Braveheart with their kilts up and their butts out. And it was called simply Moonshot.
So there's a kind of mooning that goes on. Richard, kind of stand by. We're going to take a short break. Listeners, get into the conversation online. Go to onpointradio.org and click on forums. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight with Richard Conniff. He's author of the new book, The Natural History of the Rich, a Field Guide. Richard Conniff has spent a lot of time looking at animals and insects, bugs, great and small, all over the world. This time he went out with his naturalist's eye and cast it on the rich. And one of the things, beyond dominance, which seems like the uber theme to come up here, Richard Conniff, that came up sharply to you, strongly to you, is the way in which sex is both a fascination, an attraction, and I guess also a kind of a great source of fear for the rich, because it's reproduction and potential loss all wrapped up in one.
Yes, yeah, that's they tend to refer, in a lot of families, they refer to the marital partners not as in-laws but as outlaws, and there's a great deal of scrutiny that goes on. There's also a great tendency, particularly in the British aristocracy, to intermarry so that you are amalgamating fortunes instead of dissipating them.
Conserving capital, welding it together.
Yeah. That's why you get these marriages where you have, you know, Aldriches and Rockefellers or Spencers and Churchills or Spencers and Churchills and Vanderbilts.
And
they tend to...
To put fortunes together instead of depleting them. I wish you'd jump in and read a little bit for us from your chapter, The Temptation of Midnight Feasts Sex Anyone, if you could. Here's a little bit that links human behavior and maybe something else.
Okay. When evolutionary psychologists talk about human sexual behavior, they tend to draw analogies from the animal world, and they particularly like to talk about hanging flies. These inch-long predators live by the thousands in the temperate forests of North America. They specialize in catching other insects, injecting digestive enzymes into them, and sucking out their innards. So the analogy to the behavior of rich people may seem remote. But when a male hanging fly wants romance, he goes out and catches an even bigger insect than usual and advertises his catch to the female world. Male and female pair off in the undergrowth, hanging by their forelimbs face to face like trapeze artists about to attempt an aerial minuet. He clutches the dead insect in his hind legs and holds it up to her as a nuptial gift, or to put it in human terms, he buys her dinner and she allows sex to follow. Neither male nor female is a patsy in this partnership. If the dinner is too small, she throws him out before he can do much good. It's a variation on the diamonds are a girl's best friend theme, and bigger diamonds or dead insects make better friends. It takes 20 minutes of vigorous copulation to get her to lose interest in other males and lay her eggs, and he gets 20 minutes only if he brings her a big gift. On the other hand, when his 20 minutes are up, the male may grab his nuptial gift and fly away with it to seduce other females. Does this begin to sound terribly familiar? You are probably already thinking of offensive analogies. For instance, when Donald Trump's prenuptial agreement offered second wife Marla a piece of the real money after 5 years of marriage, and he then dumped her in year four, was he not managing his reproductive assets in a manner and with a timeliness worthy of a hanging fly?
There, the calculation of the rich, whether it's a hanging fly or a billionaire, how deeply were you able to get into the sex life issue, Richard Conniff, and what did you really learn there?
The most interesting case was a guy named Lord Bath in England, whose family has lived in Longleat, an Elizabethan house, for about 300 years. It's got 200-plus rooms. And Lord Bath is a guy who's sort of caught between the 1600s and the 1960s. He's about 70 now. He looks like a pirate. He's got a ponytail, and he's a big guy, swaggers around. Mm-hmm. And he likes to do two things. He likes to paint pictures of his ancestors, going back to Tacitus in Roman times. And he also likes to paint pictures of his sex life, some of them on the walls of the private apartments of the family home.
What do we make of this, O naturalist?
He's clearly displaying his prowess. I'll tell you, the one thing that was most bizarre about his paintings is that he had, on the stairway up to his bedroom, he had portraits, or as he put it, the severed heads of every woman I have ever loved, numbered from 1 to 69, and the number's now up to, I think, 73 or 74.
Which seems like a big number, but not when you compare it with Winston Churchill's mother, who you say had 200 lovers.
Yes, but the interesting thing to me about Lord Bath is that he has remained throughout married to his first wife, and they only have two legitimate children, and therefore his son will inherit this enormous estate and the wealth that goes with it, just as he did. And therefore, his son will also be in a position to attract women, much as Dad did, and to philander. And so there's a dual strategy going on here. You minimize your legitimate reproduction, often by sticking to the first wife and having as few children as is practically possible. And then you maximize your illegitimate reproduction. Now, that's a kind of an interesting way for achieving reproductive success in animal terms and yet maintaining your capital intact for generation after generation.
So you can have it the way of the dominant ape, but still the pile of gold stays for a small number of offspring.
Yeah. Now, that's a lot more tricky now that we have paternity testing, and there are plenty
yes,
of cases that suggest that.
Yes, it is.
But it's a constant battle between culture and the natural world here, and so this is just another case of it.
It makes it sound, in purely Darwinian terms, like something to be drawn to. But I read you concluding here, Richard Cunniff, at the end of your escapade through the land of the rich, that this is a nicer kind of life to look at than to live. Why?
Well, yeah, it is. I mean, starting with that Ferrari, that was a really uncomfortable car. I just hated it.
Sure looks good on the road.
It does look good on the road, and that's why you drive it, to look good for other people. But, you know, for the driver, it's when those fumes sort of wash over you at the stop sign, it's just damned unpleasant, I thought. Anyway, and you go to these houses, 20,000-square-foot house, one person living alone, sort of rambling around there, and it's a very impressive display, but the effect on the family life is often really distorting. The effect of money on family life is that people tend to look at each other as dollar signs. And even outside the family, everybody else in the world is looking at you as a dollar sign. And so it's very hard to live a normal life and be a normal person.
You're right. The rich people I met seem to rattle around their vast enclosed spaces like zoo animals in their cages, yearning for something more, something other. What's that yearning that money's not filling there? Is it various?
Yeah, I'd say it's various. But the people who build fortunes in particular are much more in need of status than most of us. I mean, that's what drives them. And that's a healthy instinct, you know, to want to display, to want to show off, and to want to win accolades. But, you know, at the end of the day, it can also be a frustrating thing because you never quite satisfy it.
And to take us out, the three big lies of the subspecies, the three big lies of the wealthy.
Well, the rich always told me that they weren't really interested in money. They weren't really interested in power. God, never. And they didn't give a damn about impressing anybody. They were above all that. And it seemed to me that those three things were exactly what their lives were about.
Does that make them any more self-deluded than the rest of us humble creatures?
Well, I think we're all interested in money, we're all interested in power, and we're all interested in impressing other people. I suppose they do it better than we do, but I'm not sure I envy them.
In a nutshell, Richard Cunniff, having spent the time that you have with the rich working on this, how do you feel about the fact that their power in American society today is at a kind of zenith? What's the meaning of that for the country?
You know, I think that the problem is in the natural world, when you have an alpha who's getting everything that he wants, you also have betas right there watching him all the time and making sure that he doesn't go too far. And if he does go too far, one of those betas is going to rise up and smite him down. But in the world of the rich, because they're so isolated, there's nobody really watching. Or if you do have somebody watching, like a board of directors, they are often in the alpha's pocket one way or another. And so I think that what's needed is more scrutiny. I mean, you want that healthy alpha impulse, you want them driving to achieve, but you want the rest of us to be in there watching a lot more closely.
And yet, as you say, the rich tend to live lives pretty much apart, well outside of scrutiny beyond the paparazzi.
Yes. And you know, when you look at a board of directors, like in the case of Disney, you have Michael Eisner, who's got his kid's high school principal on his board of directors. He's got his lawyer and his architect. So they're all people who are beholden to him. And those are the only people who are allowed to get close. And that's just wrong.
Keeping it all in the family, just like those great apes. Richard Cunniff, thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you. It's been great.
Richard Cunniff is author of The Natural History of the Rich, A Field Guide. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Many Americans dreamed of riches in the 1990s, thanks to stock options and a booming market. But the Dow Jones Industrial Average is still down nearly 12% so far in 2002, despite a rally. And that comes on the heels of a less than stellar 2001. The painful bear market is nothing that the members of the M&D Investment Club can't handle. The group of 13 women meets once a month outside of Boston to pool their $25 monthly contributions into an investment portfolio. That portfolio has grown to about $29,000 since the club was founded in 1996. In this radio diary, members of the M&D Investment Club explain why they decided to start the club and how they're handling the recent turbulence in the stock market.
We decided to learn about investing and how to care for ourselves because we are women, and historically and traditionally, we will live longer than men. Most of us are married. And regardless of that fact, we're going to make less in our lifetime than the average man. So we have to learn how to make better choices earlier on. So we just started learning.
Our club has done 14% over the life.
Yes.
So, whereas we were flat in 2000, our other years made up. Like, 1 year we did, like, 63%.
Yeah.
So it averaged out, and we're doing about 14%.
I don't ever think we're pessimistic.
We never truly really deep in the hole through this whole downward slide. Nope. We had a couple of real dogs, but it was actually more interesting because we sold off things that were kind of holding us back, and then we had money to buy things we wanted. When things were down, we knew some different stocks we wanted, and for us, it actually wasn't too bad.
I think we have to talk about that women's shopping mentality, because then all the stocks were, like, on sale. So they were, you know, companies we had researched we knew were good, and then the prices were way down, so it was actually a good opportunity.
Yeah. It was actually a good opportunity for people like us.
We don't buy the stock market. We're buying individual equities. So we look at them individually, and we look at our portfolio. I mean, it took us how many months to figure out what the Dow 30 was? So, <Right. laughs> the Dow Jones Industrials. So that's some of those factors. We're not economists. We're fundamental analysts. We don't do any technical analysis. We don't do any quantitative analysis. We're fundamental. We look at companies. We do a bottoms up.
We look for good companies that are expected to grow, not speculative things that might take off, but things that have a proven track record. So they have to have a good history, and they have to show good potential at the same time.
Over time, the stock market always continues to rise. You know, the Dow started out in the hundreds, and I mean, even below the hundreds, and now it's back up to 8,400, and it's been over 10,000, it's been over 11,000. And the trend from day one has been an upward trend, even though it's taken a few little detours.
Every person in this room, I bet, has a retirement fund now. And not everyone did when we started. And every grandchild has some kind of an equity program going. Every grandchild from this group. So I think that that's the important part. The education is really trickled down.
Right, and it helps early. Having to do a check every month for the club got me into the routine of doing a check every month for personal portfolio, and I have two kids, their portfolios. So, you know, it's given us some discipline in our paying the future first and then spending on day-to-day stuff, and it's really made a difference.
Members of the M&D, that stands for Mothers and Daughters Investment Club, Susan Driscoll, Kara Kontos, Mary Bright, Judy McDonald, Beth Higgins, and Sandra Pasco. On Point is produced by Karen Schiffman, Meghna Chakrabarty, Alina Mata, Kelly Jones, Virginia Prescott, John Roberts, Jim Ross, Keith Shields, and Tim Skog, with help from Michael Garth, Andy Farnsworth, and Oliver Reed. Our senior producer is Graham Griffith. On Point is a production of WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
Cassettes and CDs of On Point are available for $15. Go to onpointradio.org or call 1-800-909-9287. This is WBU.